Good morning, everyone. We've just read those words, the first six verses from Hebrews chapter 11. It culminates with these words: without faith it's impossible to please him, but he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of those who seek him. He who comes to God must believe that he is. But what if that isn't you? Or what if you don't believe that God exists? What if perhaps you once did believe that God exists, but now find yourself doubting? What if you class yourself as an atheist or an agnostic? Well, over the next 25 minutes or so, we're going to look at why a belief in God is both rational and logical by looking at some of the evidences and some of the arguments for the existence of God. My own belief in God is not down to blind faith. I have a background in science and mathematics. I have a sceptical mind. I question what I'm told. I don't accept the existence of God simply because I was brought up in that way, because my parents do, my grandparents do, etc. My own belief in God requires more than that. Think about this exchange of text messages. Do you believe in God? Yes. What's your evidence for a belief in God? My belief in God isn't based on evidence. You can imagine some people saying that. There's far more to it than that. I don't need an evidence for a belief in God. Really? Do you believe in the Easter Bunny? No. Don't be daft. Why not? Because there's no evidence for it? Exactly. Oh. And we can't, on the one hand, say we don't need evidence for a belief in God. There's far more to it than that. And then, on the other hand, reject the Easter Bunny, fairies, etc., etc., because there's no evidence for them. The two things don't go hand in hand, do they? Needing evidence for a belief in God is not a sign of weak faith. When Thomas had doubts about the resurrection, Jesus provided the evidence for him. He said, put your fingers in the hands in my hole and in my sight. He didn't berate him or belittle him for his need for evidence. Seeking evidence for something is not a bad thing, but I think refusing to accept the evidence perhaps is. As Paul writes in 1 Thessalonians, examine everything carefully. Hold fast to that which is good. Those who have beliefs shouldn't be scared to test them. Those who don't have a belief shouldn't be scared to test their unbelief. And we're going to look at two of my favourite arguments for the existence of God. And the first of these is the cosmological argument. It's a deduction from the existence of the universe to a first cause. And deduction is a formal sort of argument where the conclusion necessarily follows on from the premises if the argument is sound and valid. And when it's taught in philosophy modules, it's taught in a very classic way. The example is that the first premise, Socrates is a man. The second premise, all men are mortal. And we could guess at the conclusion, Socrates, therefore, is mortal. And the argument is valid because there's no contradictions, there's no circular reasoning. And the argument is sound because both of those two initial premises are undoubtedly true. Therefore, the conclusion has to be true. And the cosmological argument is stated like this. Premise one, the universe has a beginning. Premise two, everything that has a beginning has a cause. And the conclusion, therefore, the universe has a cause. And the argument is valid. It's exactly the same form as the Socrates example that we looked at. There's no contradictions, there's no circular reasoning. But is the argument sound? Are the two initial premises true? It's not surprising that until relatively recently, the universe was thought to be essentially static and unchanging in time. In 1929, a scientist, Edwin Hubble, we've probably heard of him, whom the Hubble Space Telescope is named, discovered that the universe was expanding. And this didn't fit in with what many scientists thought was happening at the time, Einstein included. Like Einstein, three scientists, Bondi, Gold and Hoyle, were unhappy with the idea implied by Hubble's observations. They created a theory called the steady state theory, and this theory stated that as the universe expanded, new matter was being created in the widening gaps between the galaxies. And Gold and Bondi published the theory in broad terms in 1949, and Hoyle published a mathematical account of it the same year. In 1965, however, microwave background radiation was discovered, and it's the same in all directions. And there wasn't any way to explain that using the steady state theory, because if new matter was being created, well then the background radiation should be different in those areas to throughout the rest of space. And based on astronomical observations, physicists made calculations tracing the expansion of the universe backwards, so they could see that it was expanding, they could see the rate that it was expanding, therefore they could sort of chase it back to the first few moments of the universe. And the right at the moment, scientists talk about times 1 times 10 to the power of minus 43, 0.0043 zeros, 1 second after the formation of the universe. And it's what's known as the Big Bang Theory. And although it's famous, it's also widely misunderstood. A common misconception about the theory is that it describes the origin of the universe. Well, it doesn't. It only explains what's happened after the first tiny part of time. The Big Bang is an attempt to explain how the universe developed from a very, very tiny, dense state into what it is today. It doesn't attempt to explain what initiated the creation of the universe, or what came before the Big Bang, or what lies outside the universe, if there is anything outside the universe. And another misconception is that it was just some kind of explosion. That's not really accurate either. So the Big Bang describes the expansion of the universe. And it wasn't very popular among scientists when it was first talked about, because they thought it laid open the doors to religion. One reason for initial resistance to the Big Bang theory was that, unlike the rival steady state hypothesis, it proposed that the universe had a beginning, a proposition for some that had unwelcome religious implications, because if we have a beginning, well, we need to explain what happened. Andrei Zangov, who's Stalin's chief ideologue, in a speech given in 1947, described the scientists who are chief proponents of the Big Bang Theory as falsifiers of science who want to revive the fairy tale of the origin of the world from nothing. So going back to the premise of the cosmological argument, the first premise now seems to be universally accepted. In a lecture entitled The Beginning of Time, Stephen Hawking said, "All the evidence seems to indicate that the universe has not existed forever, but that it had a beginning about 14 billion years ago." Stephen Hawking is quite a strong atheist, but he's still willing to go on record and say the universe had a very clear beginning 14 billion years ago. The second premise is also generally accepted. It's our experience that things don't come into existence without a prior cause, and in fact that's what the whole of the scientific enterprise is based upon, isn't it? We observe the effects that we see, we look up to what has caused those things. So as both of those premises appear to be true, the argument is sound, and therefore the conclusion is true. The universe has a cause. So what can we say about that cause? It has to be something that is outside of the universe, i.e. outside of space and time, something that is immaterial, something that is eternal, something that's ageless, something that's always existed. It has to be something with the power to cause the Big Bang and thus create the universe. And the only thing that fits all of these characteristics is God. And if you're in a questioning mood, and that's kind of the whole point of this talk, you should be thinking, okay, God created the universe, so where did God come from? And logically, we have two choices. Either God has always existed, or something created God. And if something created God, who or what created that something? Again, we would have the same choices. It would have to be something that was outside of space and time. It would have to be something that was eternal, something that was ageless, something that had the power to create God, i.e. it would have to be God. It would have to be something with exact the same characteristics and properties that we've just said. And allegedly, a well-known scientist once gave a public lecture on astronomy, and he described how the Earth orbits the Sun, how the Sun in turn orbits around the centre of a vast collection of stars called our galaxy. And at the end of the lecture, a little old lady at the back of the room supposed to have got up and said, "What you've told us is rubbish. The world is really a flat plate supported on the back of a giant tortoise." And the scientist gave a superior smile before replying, "What's the tortoise standing on?" "You're very clever, young man, very clever," said the old lady, "but it's turtles all the way down." And the expression "turtles all the way down" is used to express the concept of an infinite regress, something that must depend on something, that must depend on something, etc., forever and ever, for infinity. And by definition, that can't exist. You can't have something that's continually dependent on something else. So the only option is that God has always existed. And God being eternal, God being everlasting, God having always existed is, of course, something that the Bible explains. "Before the mountains were born," or "you gave birth to the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God," is what the psalmist writes. "Your throne is established from of old, you are from everlasting." The eternal God is a dwelling place. So that's a brief summary of the cosmological argument. And the next thing I want us to look at is the teleological argument, and specifically the anthropic principle. And it makes us sound very clever talking about things that sound like that. Simply put, the teleological argument says if things look like they're designed, they probably are. Anthropology is a word we've probably heard of. It's the study of humans and society. So the anthropic principle looks at how the universe seems to be just right for human life. So much just right that it looks as if it's been designed in that way. And the term was first used by an astrophysicist called Brendan Carter in 1974, and an awful lot has been written about it. But an astrophysicist called Paul Davies wrote a book about the anthropic principle, but gave it a name that we understand far better. He called it the Goldilocks Enigma. Why is the universe just right for life? We can understand that idea, don't we? We know the story of Goldilocks and the three bears, how she tries the three bowls of porridge, how she sits on the three chairs, how she sleeps in the three beds, and each time it's only baby bear's bed that's just right. So the Goldilocks enigma looks at why the universe seems to be just right for human life. The image here is the Crab Nebula. When I was putting this together, I came across that picture and thought, how can I get that into my talk? I couldn't really, but I wanted to share it anyway. Space is a fascinating place. It's absolutely beautiful when you look at the pictures of it. And its discoveries in physics, in chemistry, in cosmology, people's fascination with looking into the beauty of science, of space, of everything that we look at, that has fascinated people for decades and decades, for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's discoveries in these areas of science that suggest that the existence of a stable universe, something that provides an environment that can sustain complex life, is actually a remarkably delicate phenomenon. The astrophysicist Paul Davies puts it like this: if almost any of the basic features of the universe, from the properties of atoms to the distribution of the galaxies, were different, life would very probably be impossible. And many physicists and astronomers have been struck by the surprising nature of the findings. The Nobel Prize-winning physicist Arno Pentier, he is one of the discoverers of the cosmic microwave background radiation, he reacted like this: "Astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing and delicately balanced to provide exactly the conditions required to support life. In the absence of an absurdly improbable accident, the observations of modern science seem to suggest an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan." the theoretical physicist and mathematician Freeman Dyson stated that as we look out into the universe and identify the many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked together to our benefit, it almost seems as if the universe must have in some sense have known that we were coming. And we're not going to look at the nature of our particular local environment on planet Earth, which makes it ideally suited for life forms such as ourselves, because it could be argued very easily that, well, we are here, we have adapted to fit the conditions that we find ourselves in. Instead, we're going to focus on much more fundamental considerations relating to the possibility of life occurring anywhere. And Paul Davies sets out very clearly some of the necessary conditions for life to exist. To permit life in at least one place in the universe, three basic requirements must be satisfied. The laws of physics should permit stable complex structures to form. The universe should possess the sorts of substances such as carbon that biology uses. And an appropriate setting must exist where these vital components can come together in the appropriate ways. We're going to have a brief look at each of those in turn. Much of the work that is done in physics is based on maths and computing, and because everything is so complicated, scientists create mathematical models that they use computers to experiment with. They create these models that, when they sort of put the various different numbers in, they can sort of see what happens further down the line. The laws of physics are currently understood in terms of four fundamental forces: gravity, electromagnetism, and the strong and the weak nuclear forces. And all of these forces work together in a very delicate balance, and they all seem to be necessary for stable complex structures to form. One writer puts it like this: if gravity did not exist, masses wouldn't clump together to form stars or planets. If the strong force didn't exist, protons and neutrons couldn't bind together, and hence no atoms with atomic number greater than hydrogen would exist. If the electromagnetic force didn't exist, there would be no chemistry. And as we begin to develop our understanding of these fundamental aspects of nature, we can get a clearer and clearer picture of what would happen if the strengths of these forces, or the relationships between them, were to be very, very slightly different. So, for example, it's thought now that the process of nuclear fusion that's going on inside stars is reasonably well understood. Stars are held together by gravity, and the pressure that's exerted by gravity on the interior leads to the production of energy by the breakdown of the atoms. And Paul Davies says this: an alteration in the strength of the gravitational force by a mere 1 part in 10 to the power 40 would be sufficient to throw out this numerical coincidence. In such a world, stars would then either be blue giants or red dwarfs. That 10 to the power 40 means 1 with 40 zeros after it. So if we had a 1 in 10 to the power 40 difference, then the stars wouldn't act as we clearly see them doing. The force of gravity is extremely weak, really, compared to the electrical forces that bind atoms together and keep them from collapsing, which is why stars have to be so enormously large in order to begin to exert enough pressure on the atoms at their centre to start the nuclear furnaces burning. But the formation of a stable nuclear furnace such as our own sun, that's able to burn for billions of years and supply a pretty much constant source of energy that sustains life on Earth, requires a remarkable coincidence between these strengths. The laws of physics also attempt to describe the properties and the behaviour of the fundamental particles that make up the material world. All of the matter that we're able to identify, detect, investigate, all of the matter that makes up everything on Earth, ourselves, everything that we can see in the universe around us, is made up of just a few dozen different types of atoms, the chemical elements. And these are all made out of protons, neutrons, and electrons. They are in turn made of all sorts of different things that we're not even going to talk about, because things can get complicated very, very quickly. And today isn't supposed to be a science lesson. Each of these particles, so the electrons, the neutrons, the protons, they all have very specific masses, which determines how gravity interacts with them, how gravity affects them, how they interact with other particles. Protons and neutrons are around 2,000 times heavier than electrons, but roughly the same mass as each other. And I say roughly because actually there is a very tiny difference between them. A neutron is about 0.1% heavier than a proton. And remarkably, it seems that this small difference has to be very, very precisely set to allow the universe to develop the structures that we see. If the mass of a neutron was 0.2% higher instead of 0.1% higher, then protons couldn't fuse together, and therefore the stars wouldn't be able to use hydrogen to produce the energy and release the energy that they do. If the mass of a neutron was slightly closer to that mass of a proton, then the hydrogen would be so rapidly converted to helium, and the lifetime of the stars would be like that, and then life clearly couldn't be here. And stars play a significant role in the second basic requirement for any form of life that we've listed, the production of the sorts of material substances that can be used to build a complex life. In the current scientific models of the universe, almost all of the chemical elements, so all apart from hydrogen and helium, are thought to have been formed in the nuclear furnaces of the stars. Hydrogen atoms are fused together to form helium atoms. Helium atoms are then fused together to produce the heavier elements that we see within the universe. The scientists couldn't quite see how this worked. When they started modelling this, they said, well, that seems to be what happens, but theoretically this shouldn't work. When helium atoms form together, they form a substance called beryllium. And the result is very unstable. It should fall apart almost as soon as it's formed, which allows very little opportunity for a third helium to stick together to produce something with six neutrons, carbon. And nobody could see how this process would work or could work to create any significant quantities of carbon. And carbon is one of the elements that is most abundant in the universe. Pretty much everything that we see is made up of carbon. Until the physicist Fred Hoyle suggested in 1954 that there might be a remarkable coincidence in the properties of carbon and oxygen. And you can imagine what the other scientists were saying, right, wait, so you want this to work and you're suggesting that there just happens to be this coincidence. That's all very well in producing your paper, but have you got any evidence for that whatsoever? And at the time, he didn't. But he suggested that the nuclei of carbon atoms might have a very special excited state at a very specific energy level that would correspond to the energy level of beryllium plus a helium nucleus. And he suggested oxygen wouldn't have this, which is why we have an abundance of carbon but far less oxygen within the universe. And the science writer John Gribbin and the astronomer royal Martin Rees writes, this combination of coincidences, just right for residence in carbon 12, just wrong in oxygen 16, is indeed remarkable. There's no better evidence to support the argument that the universe had been designed for our benefit, tailor-made for man. Because they have since been able to prove that that does exist. So they had this idea based on the fact that the theories aren't going to work without it. They were then able to test that and show that that actually did happen. And although Fred Hoyle remained an atheist all of his life, he said, I do not believe that any scientist who examined the evidence would fail to draw the inference that the laws of nuclear physics have been deliberately designed with regard to the consequences they produce inside stars. And the final requirement the astrophysicist Paul Davies listed was that an appropriate setting must exist in which all of these components that can come together. And despite initial resistance from some atheist scientists, the Big Bang Theory has been accepted as a reasonable description of the history of the universe by the majority of scientists today. And the idea of the whole universe expanding from a very, very tiny beginning several billion years ago and developing as it expands so that stars and planets come to be formed and life comes to emerge on at least one planet is now widely presented in popular scientific accounts. But what isn't often stressed is that this model only works if we introduce some remarkable fine-tuning into the basic constituents and initial conditions. So I said earlier, scientists model a lot of things on computers. If they don't set out those initial conditions perfectly, well then the universe on their modelling doesn't seem to form. It either expands and just keeps expanding and nothing clumps together, or it expands and then collapses down on itself. Cosmologists refer to the density of the universe using that symbol ohm. And it's absolutely crucial. If the universe emerges from the Big Bang with a density that was just a little bit too high, then it would be pulled together too strongly by gravity and would collapse on itself in a big crunch. If it was a little bit too low, then the expansion would spread the material of the universe too thinly for galaxies, stars, planets to form. And both of these are runaway processes. If the density is just a tiny bit too high, then it gets smaller and smaller quickly. If it's a tiny bit too small, it just spreads itself so thinly that nothing happens. But the Big Bang model suggests that we're now to 14 billion years away from the Big Bang, and the universe does very clearly contain many stars and galaxies, which implies that that initial density at the beginning must have been very close to the critical just right value. And John Gribbin puts it like this: in order for the universe to have lasted that long, but not to have spread itself so thin that stars and galaxies could not form at all, the value of ohm in the first second after the beginning must have been very close indeed to 1. In fact, any deviation from 1 must have been smaller than 1 part in 10 to the power 15. And there are so many other values within the universe that have to be just right. If we think about our planet Earth, the relative mass of the Earth and the Moon have to be within quite fine tolerances. The Earth has to be quite a specific distance away from the Sun. Within outside of that tolerance, then the Earth would either be too hot or too cold to support life. Almost everything that we look at within the universe, if we change those values that we find in nature just the tiniest little bit, then life couldn't happen. The best scientific theories require all of these forces to be very, very carefully balanced. And in a book by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow, they write, "Our universe and its laws appear to have a design that's both tailor-made to support us, and if we are to exist, leaves very little room for alteration. This is not easily explained, and it raises the natural question of why it is that way." And Stephen Hawking then sort of goes on to sort of try and argue, well, why things should be that way, and sort of starts talking about various different multiverses and things. And he's desperate to come up with an explanation other than the simplest explanation, that actually it was designed in that way. But when we look into the Bible, it's easy for us to see why it is that way. For this is what the Lord says: the one who created the sky, he is the true God. The one who formed the earth and made it, he established it. He did not create it without order. He formed it to be inhabited. We read in the Psalms, the heavens are telling the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. And in Romans 1, we find that Paul says, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. So for me, the two arguments that we've looked at, the cosmological argument, the teleological argument, provide a compelling case of the existence of God. The universe is here. It must have had a beginning. What was behind that beginning? the remarkable balance between all of the forces that we see around us? Who set those remarkable balance between those forces? And I want to leave you with one final quote from Robert Jastrow, a self-proclaimed agnostic, but he said this: for the scientist who's lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He's scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peaks. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. Scientists find the more they look into things, the more carefully they realise that actually everything has been put together. The more we look into science, the more evidence we find for that. Well, those who have been looking at the Bible could have told you a long time ago everything was planned. God put it together that way. Thank you very much.